BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, you're about to hear Series 3 of Lady Killers. New episodes will be released weekly. But if you're in the UK and you can't wait, you can hear the whole series now, first on BBC Sounds.
We begin this episode by paying our respects to elders, past and present, and acknowledging the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples that have contributed to the development of this program. We advise the program contains names of deceased persons in audio recordings and historical content.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. We're taking a look, well, a feminist look, actually, at crimes committed by murderesses from North America, Australia and Britain. This programme contains references to child abuse that listeners may find distressing. In this episode of Lady Killers, we're travelling to the golden shores of Eastern Australia, where a little girl is about to become the victim of a murderous matron.
I was standing at the well, and I saw her kick and beat the child with a stick. I saw the matron kick the child 4 times and drag her a few yards from where she was standing. I saw the matron ducking the child up and down in the sea.
Now, this is a horrible tragedy. The victim, a child from a community some would think of as being Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Others would call it people from the First Nations. Basically, we're talking about an Indigenous community. This area is rich in Indigenous culture, but by 1896, it's been colonised, bringing all kinds of cultural divisions. To unravel exactly what's happened here, I'm joined by our guest detective, human rights advocate and activist Vanessa Turnbull-Roberts. And you're joining us today from Belfast, where you've just received the One Young World Campaigner of the Year Award. Welcome, Vanessa.
Thank you so much for having me and allowing me to participate as a detective and provide some knowledge on the history and the current struggle that still impacts us today.
Vanessa, what seems to underpin this case is the phenomenon called Australia's Stolen Generations. These are generations of Indigenous children forcibly removed from their parents. Now, not all of our listeners will know about this, but it does affect everybody in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, doesn't it? Can you start by explaining, Vanessa, what does it mean to be from these Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities?
So when we look at First Nations identity and the way we identify, so I'm speaking here today and I'm speaking as a proud Bundjalung Widjibal Waiyabal woman. It's like when we think of Europe, we think of Greece, France, Spain, we really acknowledge all the different places within this place. But when we talk about so-called Australia, we always just think, oh, no, but it's just one place. But actually, if we did the work and we chose to respect the place we're looking at, what we would come to learn and understand is that place is broken down into over 250. Imagine if you were flying and you said, I'm actually heading to Meanjin country. And then that opened up a conversation about Meanjin country. Or you said, no, I'm flying to Gadigal country. As First Nations people, we want to be identified through our traditional place name. It's our most beautiful thing as First Nations people is our survival, our connection, and our love for community.
And what sort of proportion of people living in Australia are from the First Nations?
There's around 3-5% of the population. That's very much a result of history. That's very much a result of colonisation. But the reality is we have survived.
Let's go back into history a little bit now. When we talk about white settlement, we're talking about a process that began in the late 1700s when the British, despite being aware of the presence of Indigenous people, regarded Australia as empty and began to establish colonies there for convicted criminals and later for free settlers. You can see it as an invasion, land effectively being stolen from Indigenous communities. And over time, policies were introduced to control the Indigenous people. And this is where the idea of the stolen generations begins. Is that right, Vanessa?
Yeah, that's correct. The justification of invasion that took place from the settlers' eyes was the landis terra nullius, which ultimately means land unowned. And so invasion took place and the use of fencing was used. And as a result of that fencing and that perimeter breaking off, then in the eyes of the white man, gave onus and power to saying, well, we own the land now. And then they realised, oh no, First Nations people are actually here. Okay, how do we reinforce our power? How do we reinforce our superiority? Let's use a common sense approach. I'm a mother myself. There are probably families listening to this podcast. What would break families is, let's steal your children. Let's break your family apart. And so the stealing of children started. That actually brings us to this story of Casey and her circumstance.
Well, let's get into the detail of this particular case, which is obviously deeply rooted in the history of white settlement. As the sun rises over Minjeriba Island, the land of the Quandamooka people, just a short distance from Brisbane, a small group of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children are going down to the water's edge at Moyora Springs. Their matron, Marie Christensen, is overseeing them, and the children are all wearing the simple clothes issued to them by the Moyora Mission School. This is an institution set up by white settlers, and some of these children have been forcibly taken from their families into its care. One of the children is frailer than the rest. Her name is Casey, and she's 6 years old. As the other kids reluctantly remove their uniforms and go into the water, Marie Christensen, the matron, goes towards Casey. She wants Casey to bathe too. Casey, though, is so weak that Marie carries her in fully clothed. When they emerge from the sea, Casey collapses, and within days, she's dead. Professor Rosalind Crone from the Open University, our in-house historian, went back to the site of this mission school where little Casey died.
I'll just show you where the lily pilly tree is full in berries.
Oh, yes, please. That tree over there is supposed to be over 600 years old.
Really?
Yeah. The really fat.
Yeah, the gum.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow. Well, I have come to Minjeriba, which is the traditional name for North Stradbroke Island, one of four sandbanks off the coast of Brisbane, the largest, actually. I'm very lucky. I'm joined by Mary Burgess, who is part of the Minjeriba Morgumpan Elders in Council. Mary, thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome today on Quandamooka Country, and I'd like to acknowledge our traditional owners, the Noonuggle, Noongee and Gurrumpal, and pay our respects to our traditional owners, past, present and future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. That's a beautiful welcome. Now, I'm here today because we believe this was the site of the Moyora Mission set up in the late 19th century. Now, as I understand it, missions were part of a system of management that was set up by white settlers in the 19th century to control the indigenous population.
Yes. That's correct. Yes, it was.
Yeah. Now, it's really idyllic here today. I can hear bird noise, also a bit of traffic noise. It'd be good to think about what this would have been like in the 19th century, because I don't think it necessarily would have looked like this.
It would have had all the cabins around this area, you know, living quarters for the families. They were called umpies, bark huts, umpies, sand on the floor. And they had hessian bag covering the doorway. Basically, that's what it was like.
Mary, I'd love to know a little bit more about what life was like on the mission, because your mum was on the mission.
Yes.
At the end.
That's really. Right. Yeah. Mum was here in the late 1940s before the mission closed down, and she lived here with her mum and dad, brothers and sisters, and they were controlled by the white settlers here on the island. Made to live here, and their traditional culture they were denied. Their speaking of their language, hunting, the men's rituals they were denied. Families were removed from here and sent to other missions. So sort of tried to divide the people.
Yeah, and there's an even darker element to it, which we should talk about. As part of the mission, there was also a school.
Yes.
And the school was for the children who lived here.
Mm-hmm.
But also they had children who had been removed from their families
mm-hmm.
and brought here.
That's
right.
That's yeah. correct, yeah.
Do you know what it would have been like for children living on the mission?
I remember my mum talking to us and telling us it was very frugal. They were given a cheaper type of cloth, or she even mentioned sack bags for sure. You know, they made baggy pants out of sack bags. They were not fancy, no waste or anything.
This is a school that's not educating these children for opportunities. This is not about social mobility. This is about assimilation.
That's right.
It's giving them the basics to operate in white society. In
domestic services, yes.
Labouring.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, Vanessa, it can't be easy to listen to that. How do you react?
With hurt, with outrage. You see the way it continues to come up in our worlds today. And it actually helps us understand the issues that we see today in society, and in particular the issues within the jurisdiction of Queensland, where we see such a strong reinforcement of punishment and harm used against children and young people, and in particular Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and young people.
Hmm. Well, I've now got Roz here in the studio today, and turning to you, Roz, it was here that our matron, Marie Christensen, came to work. Roz, what do we know about her?
Well, we actually know very little about Marie Christensen. From the records of the case, they state she was about 40 years old and that she was Danish, and also that she was not married.
So she's come and ended up working here as the matron. Can you tell us anything more about Casey, the little girl who was at the school?
Yeah, again, we know very little about this child. From the records of the case, we know that she arrived in the mission around about July 1896, but we know absolutely nothing of her parents or where she was from. We have got a list of children who were attending the school.
Oh,
and if you look down,
yes.
Yeah, you will see a child there called Sissy, who is about the age of our child.
You think Sissy might be Casey?
I think it's very likely it is Casey, and it is yet another example of how bad this place is and how much they devalue and dehumanise the children who came here. They can't even get her name right in the documents. They're not bothered, are they?
And to just comment on the archives and Sissy and the way the name has been denied, names were changed because that was part of denying Aboriginality and identity. And when you speak to the survivors who I've had the privilege of learning with and sharing, you often hear the survivors speak with their numbers because they were identified as numbers, and then they go into their story. So when we look at the current agenda of the way we politically protest right now, we often say their name. Say their name so we don't forget. Say their name so we know who they are. Say their name so we don't ever stop fighting for their rights.
Vanessa, can we turn to your own experience for a moment? Because the work you do is motivated by first-hand experience, isn't it? Although we are looking at a historical case in our programme today, you are a survivor of what's sometimes called the family policing system. Can you explain this to us?
Absolutely. So I'm a survivor of family policing. It's quite often known globally and around the world as being welfare or being out of home care, or known as foster care. When you look at the use of surveillance and regulations on Indigenous and Black and Brown families around the world, but in particular in Australia, we see police officers coming to our homes and removing our children with social workers and these people who are meant to act in positions of care, but actually are acting in positions of often more harm than good, even when there's a well-intentioned organisational ideology behind it. And in my story and my situation, I do remember the night that I was taken, and it was the middle of the night and I was about to close my eyes. And I remember looking out the window and seeing red and blue flashing lights coming down. So I grew up in a community where, we were the subject of poverty. Yeah, often we didn't have enough food. And yeah, we struggled. So where was the adequate support? Instead of support, we got punitive measures and we got harmful responses such as child removal. So my story and my work is driven by being forcibly removed and wanting to ensure that other children and young people, in particular families, are supported. And so when I hear the story of Casey, who is a six-year-old First Nations person ripped away from her family, this is just the one story that we've been told about. This is the one story that's been documented.
Hmm. So Casey, like many others, was in the so-called care of this mission institution then when something happened. Voz joined Mary Burgess back on Minjeribub Island, where our story continues.
Mary, you've brought me to, well, what to me seems like a bit of a paradise. We've got this beautiful stream running past here. We've got these beautiful trees bending over into the stream. Can you tell me what this place is?
This is Myora Springs, and this is where we were children. Families would always come here and come and bathe. Actually, the scenery's changed a lot with the boardwalk and that. It was all just like a sloping bank, and there would have been a bit of grass over here where families sat and enjoyed the water when the tide was in. And there was actually a waterfall over there, and there was a deep hole that the water poured into, and you could swim out to it and have a little dive in and play.
We've come to Myora Springs because we believe this is the place where the children from the mission would be brought down to bathe. It happened to be a fateful day on the 14th of September 1896 when our case really started.
I gave her a salt water bath. She refused to walk. I took up a small switch and gave her a few cuts with it.
Casey is known to be unwell. However, Marie Christensen just won't have this. Even when witnesses report seeing Casey collapse, Marie insists that she walk back up the hill to the mission. Polly Roberts, who lives at the mission, sees what's been happening on the beach.
I was standing at the well and I saw her kick and beat the child with the stick. I was standing about 400 yards from where this all happened.
When the beatings fail to have any effect on Casey, Marie grabs her by the arm and drags her up the hill. As they get near the mission, 17-year-old Topsy McLeod, an Indigenous girl working on the mission, sees what's going on from the kitchen window.
I saw her use a small switch on the child, and I saw her kicking the child, and she hit her as far as the swing, about 40 yards from where she hit her first.
Marie finds a second switch and thrashes Casey with it. Then she hurries to her room inside the mission and comes back with a bigger weapon, a cane, which she uses to go on beating the girl. Marie Christensen is shouting, which attracts the attention of more of the mission residents. Out from her bark hut comes Budlu Lafu.
She told me, "You have nothing to do with it," and sent me away.
Budlow's children attend the school, and Budlow and Marie have clashed before over Marie's treatment of the kids. Budlow rushes to pick Casey up, but Marie won't let her.
The child was inert and gasping.
Budlow reluctantly does go away. She's mindful of Marie's authority as a white mission worker. There could be trouble for Budlow and her own family if she doesn't obey. From here, poor Casey is taken to her dormitory, where Topsy says Marie continues the caning. Casey, already weak and underweight, now stops eating. On the 17th of September, the schoolmaster, Atkinson Dunnington, steps in.
Marie, if I were you, I would send for the doctor, as Casey's not well.
The next day, Marie finally agrees to call a doctor. Dr. Joseph Patrick Maloney, acting medical superintendent, examines Casey. He prescribes whiskey as a stimulant. At 11 o'clock the next morning, Marie contacts Maloney again, this time to notify him that at 10:30 that morning, Casey had died. Now, the death of a child is a terrible thing. Now, there's a witness here in the records called Polly Roberts, and your name is Vanessa Turnbull Roberts. Is it possible that this Polly could have been one of your own ancestors?
When I heard the name Polly Roberts, I couldn't help but think that could be my family member, that could be someone I know. I'm a strong believer that while she was the eyewitness of this murder, I'm extremely privileged here today to speak to the listeners and speak to this story with my voice. She was the eyes, and now I get to be the voice.
Now, There were unusual circumstances, Voss, to Casey's death, but it could have gone unnoticed, couldn't it?
Yeah, well, simply put, the doctor who attended Casey, that's Dr. Maloney, he refused to sign the death certificate because he had only seen the child once. He wasn't her regular physician. And that lack of a death certificate then triggered an inquest. Now, it's a standard legal process, right, but it becomes really remarkable when you put it into context. According to the legal historians Sean Guglas and John Weaver, in 1896, there were 469 formal inquiries into sudden deaths, so inquests, in Queensland, but fewer than 1% of these investigated the deaths of Aboriginal people.
So it's really unusual that in this case we have an inquest happening into the death of somebody from a First Nations community.
It is really unusual, and then it gets even more interesting. The Justice of the Peace on the island at that time was a man called William North, or Bill North, as he was known. He ran cattle on Minjirabar, and there is evidence to suggest that Bill was quite closely connected to the local Indigenous population, okay? He provided employment for some of the people on the mission, and he even sent his own children to the mission school. When he went about investigating the case, he drew on the Indigenous people, the women of the mission, and he asked for their testimony.
So this is good, I suppose, that he's taking witnesses' statements.
Yeah, it sounds good, doesn't it? However, there's yet another twist to the tale here. Apparently, when North wrote down Budlo Lefou's statement, he left out a key part, that Budlo had seen Marie Christensen use a cane on Casey.
I asked him why he hadn't put it in. He did not say anything.
Vanessa, is this ringing a bell at all, that evidence from First Nations witnesses might not always be included as it should be?
Absolutely. When we look into murdered and missing Aboriginal women, we see the way those in positions of power, such as policing, don't take First Nations women seriously when it comes to investigations or calling out for support, which is part of the reason why many of our women won't go to the police, because there is a trust barrier. And when we look at this case of Casey and we look at today, not much has changed at all.
The case goes to the magistrate's court. The magistrate, Philip Pinnock, determines that there is a case to be heard. Marie is ordered to stand trial at the next sitting of the Supreme Court. And it's here that she pleads guilty to beating Casey. It's for the court to decide what to do with her. The Supreme Court judge thinks that,
by appearance, the woman does not seem to possess a very large amount of intelligence.
The Home Secretary also wrote a letter saying,
she is not of a very strong mind.
And Dr. Mahoney, the doctor who'd come to treat Casey, believes that
she was a woman of imperfect brain development.
What's going on here then? When Marie appears in court and pleads guilty, suddenly all of these important people seem to be saying that she's not a murderess, she's somebody incompetent. Were they trying to get her off?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's highly likely that a deal had been done behind the scenes. This allowed the blame for what had happened to be contained, right, and focused on one individual rather than falling on the institution as a whole or indeed the whole system of missions. It's the idea of the bad apple. If you get rid of the bad apples, then everything's okay. And it really deflects attention from looking at the institution as a whole and how it allows bad apples to operate. Really, the whole thing is just completely rotten.
Vanessa, how does that sound to you? Do you hear anything that makes you think of the present day?
Absolutely. Nobody wants to talk about the systemic impacts of what these institutions have done and continue to do to our communities. And I don't think those who implemented these policies and those practices are ready to do that.
Mm.
And particularly in this time with Casey, are ready to do that.
So, Roz, back to the case of Marie Christensen. What does happen to her next?
They impose a sentence of 2 years imprisonment with hard labour, but they suspend it and give her a good behaviour bond for £100 and insist that she goes into the care of the Salvation Army.
Given what she'd done, does that sound quite lenient to you, Vanessa?
I know of children and young people that have stolen a packet of chips that get far more consequences and harsher responses from policing and the court system than what this person has received. Now, in my opinion and in my knowledge, this is not justice.
Voss, can you tell me what happened to the rest of the children from the mission school?
Yes, well, the mission continued right into the 1940s, but just days after the trial, the reformatory and industrial school, that part of it was all shut down. So the children were scattered. Some went to the western side of Brisbane and some were sent into work.
Mm. And do we know what became of Marie Christensen herself?
We do. We actually find her again in the records. Only a year later, we find her in the insanity register. I'll just pass that one over to you. In 1897.
Insanity?
Yeah.
Mm. So even if the whole play at the time of the trial was that this woman is ill, that obviously stuck and she did end up in some sort of an institution.
Yeah.
Gosh. We've gone as far as we can with the case of Casey, I think, but this business of children being taken from their parents is far from over, isn't it, Vanessa, as you've argued. Where do we go from here, do you think, into the future?
In terms of when we look at historical implications of child removal, then I'd encourage listeners to look into things like the National Bring Them Home Report, which really goes into the separation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and voices survivors and the impact. And I think when it comes to addressing the fundamental crisis of family policing and statutory out-of-home care, we need to recognise that we are 3.5% of the population, but yet we make over 70% of the statutory out-of-home care system, and we are overrepresented in every single state and territory in Australia. There's a national crisis that we're facing, and that national crisis results from history, and it results from a continued stolen generation that hasn't stopped.
So Casey, just 6 years old, lost her little life at the hands of not only a murderous woman, but also at the hands of a morally corrupt system. A system built on prejudice, and a system whose legacy lives on today. We can't fully understand how Marie Christensen's life played out, but we will not and we should not forget what happened to little Casey that day on the beach. A huge thank you to our guest detective, Vanessa Turnbull-Roberts, Professor Rosalind Crone and Mary Burgess. Next time on Lady Killers, we are exploring the case of Jane Boyd. Jane's unmarried teenage daughter, Anne, was sent home in disgrace from her job as a domestic servant because she was pregnant. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Nicola Humphreys, and the readers are Paula Delaney-Nazarski, Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. Sound design is by Chris McLean and the series producer is Julia Habel. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up on the whole series if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. What can the Lady Killers cases teach us about the authenticity of women's stories? The Open University takes a look at how we can reclaim female voices from history. Go to bbc.co.uk and search for Lady Killers, where you can follow the links to the Open University. Thanks for listening. If you're enjoying Lady Killers, we have a brand new episode every week. But if you're in the UK and you can't wait, you can hear all the episodes now, first on BBC Sounds.
It was about 2:30 in the morning, and every time in that moment of waking, I would see the man standing in the corner.
It's here. Uncanny. Season 3.
She was just walking, non-responsive, without talking, without blinking. It seemed like something has just taken over.
Terrifying real-life encounters with the supernatural.
What I saw in that house frightens me, and I wish I'd never seen it.
Listen on BBC Sounds, if you dare.